righty, welcome back, everybody. It is the Tim Conway Jr. Show live on 97.1 FM Talk. And we do the news every night at 9 o'clock. We have a special guest here, a very popular psychiatrist, right?
Yeah.
Yes, he's been on Oprah Winfrey. And you go by Dr. Reef, right?
Right, Dr. Reef.
All right, Dr. Reef, nice to see you, man.
Thanks for having me.
All right, and we'll get into a bunch of, I know, because we have probably, and I'm including myself in this, so I'm not, you know, throwing the listeners under the bus, but the most psychologically damaged audience, I think, in all of radio.
Well, that's why I'm here. You know, I figured I could get some patients, hang out, have some fun. It's, you know, good times.
And I'm putting myself as the king. I used to call Brian Whitman the king of, what was it, the disabled?
The king of the damaged.
The king of the damaged. But I think I've taken over as the king of the damaged.
Well, congratulations.
Yes, exactly. And you were on Oprah on Monday, right?
Yeah.
Look at you.
Big story on heroin.
On heroin. I heard it's popular in Ohio right now.
Yeah, wow, you watched.
Yeah, I looked at a little of that, yeah.
I'm impressed.
Yes,
that's
thank
great.
You very much. Well, my my wife watches Oprah, and I can always tell when she's watched it, because when I get home, whatever the topic was on Oprah, if that's directly affecting our marriage, it's pretty quiet that night at home.
So that night, did she ask you if you had heroin, like, under the mattress or something?
No, but I called Continental Airlines and tried to get a one-way ticket to Ohio. Seems like a fun state, huh? Lots of heroin going on. All right, Dr. Reef is with us, and we're going to do the news here with Gina Grad, everybody.
Now, from the 97.1 newsroom. Back up.
What do you do when they turn on what?
Here's Gina Grad with the news.
What do you do when they turn on what?
Yeah. That must be so weird through Reef's ears, listening to that. Dr.
Probably.
Reef. A little weird.
Yeah.
Learned a little bit about you. That's fine.
You know, this is so great. I see you brought your prescription pad, too.
Yeah, just in case.
God.
Beautiful, man. Let's C-O-N-W-A-Y is how you spell the last name. And I'm with Longs over on in the valley.
Yeah, they know you, they told me.
Little Christmas list.
All right, here we go. Gina, what's going on with that news?
Well, as you know, the one and only vice presidential debate occurred this evening at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. This was held to watch Senator Biden and Governor Palin go head-to-head on issues like health care, tax reform, and energy policies. In this first bit of audio, we see that even though these two candidates had many, many differences of opinion, the one thing they had in common was they couldn't always answer the question.
Mm.
First, we have Biden.
Biden couldn't answer a question?
Yes, Senator Joe Biden,
confused.
Here we
go.
You both would like to be vice president. Senator Biden, how, as vice president, would you work to shrink this gap of polarization which has sprung up in Washington, which you both have spoken about here tonight?
Well, that's what I've done my whole career, Gwen, on very, very controversial issues, from dealing with violence against women to putting 100,000 police officers in the street to trying to get something done about the genocide and what was going on in Bosnia.
Did he hear the question?
I think he heard it.
He did. Okay.
Yeah.
And I have been able to reach across the aisle. I think it's fair to say that I have almost as many friends on the Republican side of the aisle as I do the Democratic side of the aisle. But am I able to respond to? Are we able to stay on the?
You may, if you like.
Yeah. Well, you know,
I have no idea what she's saying.
Until 2 weeks ago, it was 2 Mondays ago. John McCain said at 9 o'clock in the morning that the fundamentals of the economy were strong. 2 weeks before that, he said, George, we've made great economic progress under George Bush's policies. 9 o'clock, the economy was strong. 11 o'clock that same day, 2 Mondays ago, John McCain said that we have an economic crisis. That doesn't make John McCain a bad guy, but it does point out he's out of touch. Those folks on the sidelines knew that 2 months ago.
All right. Well, that wasn't the whole story. I mean, the whole story was John McCain said that the American worker was strong.
Yeah.
And he didn't say the economy. He said, you know, the American worker was strong. I mean, we're, you know, kicking ass. So a little misleading.
Governor Palin does address that.
All right. And she misses the question, too?
She's, a little off the mark on her response.
All right. Here we go.
Governor Palin, you may respond.
John McCain, in referring to the fundamental of our economy being strong, he was talking to and he was talking about the American workforce.
Ah, see,
and the
nailed
American
it.
Workforce is the greatest in this world with the ingenuity and the work ethic.
Did she hear the question?
I think so.
They both heard the question.
As far as I know, neither one of them are hard of hearing.
That is just entrenched in our workforce.
You know what she's done? She's lost that high tone. That, hello.
Well, she slips in and out of it. I think there was probably a direct instruction to take it down an octave.
I think when she knows what's up, right, she loses the school teacher voice.
Yeah, she's not quote unquote adorable as they accuse her of being.
Well, and again, you know much more about psychiatry than I do. Well, at least I hope you do. But when guys, and I know that men and women do this, but when you talk to somebody in the workplace who is a superior of yours, your voice goes up. Uh-huh. And when you talk to somebody who is below you, your voice goes down. Is that true?
Yeah, there's some truth to that. Also, if you know what you're talking about, your voice tends to go down. And if you're unsure, like if you see people in malingering when you're trying to detect if somebody is lying or not,
right?
You know, like you look at them and sometimes their eyes roll up and they kind of, if they're not sure of the answer or they're trying to fake you
start
out.
Darting around. Right.
Yeah, their eyes dart off and their eyes dart up and their voice goes up.
Yeah,
So it's a lot of body language,
and you can tell a lot by looking at somebody.
Yeah, I'm looking at you right now, and I'm seeing all sorts of stuff. It's crazy. And I'm keeping it to myself, too.
I can't even see you from over here. I'm so much lying I do. All right, here we go. We continue with Governor
Palin.
Of
course, that's a positive, that's encouragement, and that's what John McCain meant. Now, what I've done as a governor and as a mayor is truly had that track record of reform, and I've joined this team that is a team of Mavericks with John McCain, also with his track record of reform, where we're known for putting partisan politics aside to just get the job done. Now, Barack Obama, of course,
I think we get it. Now, you know, it's going to be a really long, cold winter if she loses. Mm. She's got to go back to Alaska instead of Washington, D.C.
Where the sun sets at about noon.
Yeah. I mean, that's a big difference. You know, sitting in Alaska where the sun comes up for 2 or 3 hours a day or being vice president of the United States of America.
I know. Going back to Russia, Alaska, same thing.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
Same difference.
Crazy. All right. What else is going on with the news there, Gina?
Well, meanwhile, even though this wasn't exactly a love fest between the two candidates, Biden and Palin did show some moments of affection for their opponent. In this clip, Biden chides McCain on his foreign policy, but shows that he appreciates him nonetheless.
All righty, here we go.
John McCain was saying the Sunnis and Shias got along with each other without reading the history of the last 700 years. John McCain said there'd be enough oil to pay for this. John McCain has been dead wrong. I love him. As my mother would say, God love him, but he's been dead wrong on the fundamental issues relating to the conduct of the war. Barack Obama has been right. They're the facts.
Doesn't matter.
Now, did you notice there was a lot of that from Biden tonight? A lot of, I respect Governor Palin. I respect John McCain. I love John McCain, however.
He's an idiot, right? Yeah. No, I, like when they said, I don't understand that in an argument, you know. It's like, you know, I love Randy, but what an a-hole.
Yeah.
You know?
I don't mean that in a bad way.
Yeah. I mean, listen, the biggest heart, he's one of the greatest guys ever, but what an effing a-hole that guy is. Right? And that's what you're saying. I don't understand, why people do that.
Yeah.
All right, what else is going on in the news there, Gino?
Well, finally, in the debate news, when the candidates were asked if there was anything they would change about their campaign up until this point, Governor Palin gave an odd reason as to why she wouldn't change a thing.
Oh, boy, here we go.
So, Governor, as Vice President, there is nothing that you have promised as a candidate that you would that you wouldn't take off the table because of this financial crisis we're in?
There is not, and how long have I been at this? Like 5 weeks? So there hasn't been a whole lot that I've promised except to do what is right for the American people, put government back on the side of the American people, stop the greed and corruption on Wall Street, and the rescue plan has got to include that massive oversight that Americans are expecting and deserving. And I don't believe that John McCain has made any promise that he would not be able to keep either.
There you go. But see, isn't that always wrong? I mean, aren't these guys always promising stuff that they never deliver?
You got to win.
Yeah.
It's just, you can't please everybody and you want everybody's vote. So
it's unbelievable.
Do you think anybody's going to play this back tomorrow and do a drinking game and drink every time she says, you have to stop the greed and corruption on Wall Street?
Yeah. Or maybe every time Biden says Bushes.
Bushes.
You know, I think the 18 to 34 demographic, basically, if they turn the sound off, they voted for Palin.
Yeah,
that's true. But
what cheekbones?
You know, she brought up something ridiculous the other day. She brought up age. She said, I read one of your speeches when I was in second grade. right? And she shouldn't be doing that when she's running with a, you know, next to a guy who's 98 years old. All right, what else is going on in the news there,
Well,
Gina?
Finally, in world news, India banned smoking in public places on Thursday, leaving public health officials with a much tougher task, which is getting the nation's estimated 120 million smokers to step out their cigarettes.
That should be easy.
Yep. As more countries have clamped down on smoking in recent years, Indians have freely puffed away at playgrounds, you know, like you, railway stations, sidewalk cafes, hospitals. But now a violator will get the equivalent of a $5 fine, which, you know, is a lot of money. But while most people are against this new ban, some people are pretty happy about it. We have some audio of that.
All right. The last reason to visit India is gone.
This is a very good step by the government. Smoking's harmful for both the active smoker and the passive smoker. Putting a ban on it was compulsory. This is a good step the government has taken.
You know, it's sort of ironic. I buy all my cigarettes from Indians.
Do you?
Yeah.
Would you like a cigarette? I'm Indian. I can do that.
Is that
it's
right?
Okay. Yeah. And I don't smoke. See, look. It works.
He's a master impressionist.
That's a pretty good accent. Yeah. How long how long has your family been in this country?
Well, you know, I'm East African Indian. So my parents, grandparents, great-grandparents are all from Africa. My uncle's a race car driver.
Is that
on the
right?
Safari circuit in Kenya. It's pretty crazy.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's fun. But originally I'm Indian, so I can do an Indian accent. I think it's just like, it just comes with the territory.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, excellent. Awesome. All right, Gina, what else is going on in the news?
That's what's going on.
All right, the news with Gina Grad, everybody.
The news with Gina Grad.
Son, shut up.
Give us 8.5 minutes, and we'll give you, well, that.
There you go. All right, Gina's going to stay with us here. Dr. Reif is with us. And again, he is a world-renowned psychiatrist and maybe able to help you out with some of the problems going on. Everybody is worried about the economy. Everybody is worried about keeping their jobs, their mortgages. Inflation is coming up. You know, financially, everybody is strapped. You got kids that are, you know, parents that are putting these kids in private schools at $20,000, $25,000 a year that can barely afford that. And everybody is nervous as hell. There's depression. There's anxiety out there. And if you're suffering from something like that, you know, you don't feel like your old self. We're going to talk to Dr. Reif here. Maybe he can give you a couple of tools to help you out, you know, at least let you, you know, at least give you a breather and try to give you, you know, some skills or some tricks to try to live a happier life again. And here are the phone numbers. Again, if you're down and out and you're looking for some great inside help, a guy who's, you know, spent years and years examining problems, he's probably never, ever going to get a phone call where he's stumped. I mean, he's heard it all. He's seen it all. And so if you have a problem and you want some great advice, 520-9710. That's 520-9710 and 888-520-9710. Now, specifically, what I'd like to, maybe in this hour we can talk about this, as well as if you have any other problems. But I read an article recently on the internet that people who live at home past age 30, that is it is wildly psychologically damaging to those people. Is that true?
Yeah, you know, there's definitely some truth to that. They did a research study that was a pretty decent-sized study that looked at three different groups of people, right, in high school when you're growing up. You know, you have the group of people that is the hardcore stoners, burnouts. They wear the rock concert shirts, right, and they're getting high all the time. You know, the guys...
That's our audience.
Yeah, like everyone here. Right. No, the real hardcore experimenters, they're one group. Then the second group are people that do nothing. Don't drink, don't ever do anything wrong, don't do anything bad at all, don't test boundaries at all. And then the third group is kind of recreational. You know, they'll test a little bit, they'll do a little bit, they'll drink a little bit here, they have that one bad night. And they looked at them to see, as they grew up into adults, which ones were the most successful group.
So and let me guess.
Take a guess.
All right, I'm going to guess it's the ones that always took chances.
Always took chances, like you.
Yeah.
Or like your audience.
Well, no, I wouldn't put myself in that group. But I'm talking about people who maybe, you know, gambled at a young age. They questioned the authority of the teacher, and right, they were sort of, you know, it's like, you know, the kids that had a paper route at age 12 or 13 or selling candy in the neighborhood, like the go-getters, but the people that also broke the rules and were in trouble with the law or with their teachers or parents quite often.
You know, it depends on how many laws you broke. Like the recreational ones, which were, you know, maybe they drank a little bit here and there, maybe they did a couple things wrong, maybe they froze the pool when they were, you know, it was just
right,
stuff that didn't land them in jail.
Right.
Not the hardcore sociopath Catholic burnout kids that set cats on fire and stuff like that. The ones that were just recreational, far and away, were the best group. They're the ones that were the most successful, really exceeded expectations. The funny thing is, you would think the kids that were like in the library all day were going to be grow up to be great kids or great adults and do really successful things.
Didn't happen.
And they just barely beat out the burnouts. They were wearing AC/DC t-shirts, smoking pot in the basement. Yeah.
Is it because it has so much to do with the fact that you have to have street smarts and social skills, and kids that were sort of confined to their rooms didn't develop that?
Yeah, that's totally itching. But part of it is the fact that you're completely sheltered and you don't develop any life skills, right? And the other part of it is you don't differentiate and create your own identity in life. And that's, I think, applies to what you're saying about these kids at 30, like Bruno, the bouncer who lives in his mom's basement that doesn't get out very much. He doesn't have his own identity to live his life and develop life skills. So, yeah, it definitely sets you back when you're living at home.
Dr. Reif is with us. It's sort of like, I've heard this before, and Doug Steckler used to mention this quite often, that sociopaths treat everybody the same and on the same level. They'll treat their boss the way they treat their kids, their cleaners, like they treat the guy who pumps their gas, like their neighbors. Everyone gets the same level of treatment, and that's a bad sign.
Yeah, you know, the sociopath, it's interesting. We think of like Hannibal Lecter as the ultimate sociopath, right? And it's you got to eat people or you got to kill people to be a sociopath. Some of the best CEOs of companies are sociopaths.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Sociopath, basically, it just means you have little regard for other people's safety or other people's feelings. And there's very much a I'm doing this for me kind of vibe, and I don't really care about rules and regulations and what's normative in society at all. So you can utilize those skills to actually do well in regards to a company, running the show, doing things like that. But at some point, if you cross the line and you believe that the law does not apply to you, then you're going to hear about that sociopath in the news.
Right. All right. Now, Dr. Reif is with us. You've traveled, obviously, at least throughout the United States, perhaps the world. Do you think that, and I have a theory that Los Angeles is the capital of look at me, the narcissistic capital of the world. Is that true?
It's partially true. Wow. I would say we have the two biggest personality disorders of all in the U.S. in L.A. are histrionic and narcissistic.
Now, what is histrionic?
Okay, so histrionic is the dramatic, oh my God, everything's so crazy in my life, oh my God. You know, it's that.
Reif, I'll thank you to leave my personal life out of this.
Yes, basically, I'm looking at Gina right now, but that's okay.
But but out here, in the Midwest at least, you get that only from the female side. But out here, you get it from guys as well.
Oh, yeah, I'm not gender specific on this one. There are just as many dramatic guys in L.A. as there are women. They're presented differently.
Yeah, but what a huge turnoff. And I'm not even talking about necessarily gay guys. Straight men who are just are just gossip queens.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, did you hear about Bob? He was like, at the bar. And also, it's how you present yourself in the drama. You're going to see a lot more guys getting angry with their girls and getting all jealous and getting all, uptight about what's going on. And they're just presented differently. Maybe they're not like, oh my God, but they might be like, yo, what are you doing? And they get it. They get in someone's face and there's no need to. And you see fights and drama, and there's guy drama just as much as there's girl drama.
Yeah. All right. Dr. Reif is with us. If you'd like to ask him a question, perhaps you're about to kill yourself out there. 520-9710, or perhaps maybe something a little lighter. All right. 520-9710 and 888-520-9710. Now, I'm 44 years old. I'll be 45 in 2 weeks. Very proud of that. And I noticed that myself, as well as my friends that I've grown up with, I have like a group of 15, 20 friends who I've known since about third grade. And we're all still in touch. I speak to them, at least one or two of them every day, and email them. We're just a very tight group of guys. And I noticed that we're all starting to get into who gives an F. I mean, that attitude of, I don't want to do anything, I'm burning out. Is that something that happens to guys in the mid-40s?
I think it's how you create your identity. When you're in your late 20s, mid-30s, through your 30s, you're kind of like, you feel invincible when you're really young. When you're your late teens, your 20s, you're invincible. I can do anything. I'm Superman. Right. I can do whatever I want. I can do drugs. I can do this. I can do that. Then you start getting into your 30s and you're like, wait, what's my sense of purpose? I should be doing something. You know, I should be doing something with my life. I'm going to go to school. I'm going to work. I'm going to work hard. I'm going to do this and that. Then you get into your 40s and you're like, well, did I make the right choices?
Right.
I don't know. You know, all that work I did in my 30s, is that right? Like, should I be married to this woman? Should I be hanging out here? Should I be living in? You start questioning a lot of things.
Right.
And when you question, that can lead to apathy, or it can lead to people going, all right, midlife crisis, I'm changing things up. I'm buying a fast car. I'm changing my job. I'm doing.
Maybe getting a little earring.
Yeah.
Getting a little earring.
Never a
is,
that,
is there such thing as male menopause?
Not physically, obviously, but
psychologically?
Yeah, I think you can feel like you've reached this point in your life where, you know, things change and you've reached this age where, in the metaphor of menopause, you leave your life differently, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I think the myth of it is, there's truth to it.
And what about guys that, and I have, I only have one friend like this, but he'll be 45, or maybe he is 45 already. He's never been married, never has kids. And he's treated like a pariah with all of our wives. I mean, everyone looks at him like he's a complete nut. He's he's a guy. You know, he gets a lot of chicks, but he just never found the right one. He wants to get married, but he never has been. He wants to have kids, but he doesn't have kids. And he's 45. Is that something that psychologically can a 45-year-old guy get married and still have kids?
Yeah, I think if you would have asked that question 20 years ago,
right,
the answer would be totally different. 20 years ago, not in L.A., you know, that guy would be like, you know, on a like scary Axis of Evil list, like the poster board to stay away from, right?
Right?
Now, there's so many people in their late 30s, early 40s, mid 40s that are still single. You could call them commitment phobic if you want.
Right.
Maybe they haven't met the right people. Maybe they've been working all the time. I'm meeting more and more people, patients, friends, whoever, that are like, you know, I don't know if I want kids.
Yeah.
I don't know if I want to get married. I'm cohabitating with somebody and I'm digging it. You know, times are changing a bit.
You know, I was, and again, Dr. Reif is with us. I was that way. I didn't want to have kids at all and I never wanted to get married. And I met my now wife. I met her about 10 years ago. And I kept putting it off. I put off the marriage, and I put off the engagement. I put off having kids. And I didn't want to have kids. And we got married. And we agreed to try to have a kid. And I heard that if you had a cell phone in your pocket, that it reduces the sperm count. So I put one in each pocket and two in my underwear and walked around like an idiot for 3 years. But boom, we had a kid. We had a beautiful daughter named Sophia, and she's going to be three come Sunday. And it changed my life. I now can never imagine myself not having kids. I think it was the best thing that's ever happened to me, and words could never describe how much I love my daughter. Yeah. I mean, it really does change guys around, but I change in a heartbeat. I mean, I never wanted to have kids, ever, and now I can't imagine, not having a kid.
Yeah, it's one of those, you know, I've delivered a few babies, and even though I'm a psychiatrist, I went to medical school, so I delivered babies and had some surgery, and it was... It was one of the most disgusting but awesome things I've ever experienced.
So honest.
Well, you know what they never told us when we were having our child?
It was awesome, but it was like disgusting.
Yeah, it really is disgusting.
Yeah.
But they never told you that the kid could have a cone head when they're born, right? So my daughter had this big cone head, and the doctor or the nurses never said anything. And I'm looking around going, hey, we got an alien in the room and nobody's saying anything here. And luckily it went down, but they should have warned me about that. I thought we were going to have like a Bozo the Clown as a daughter.
Well, X-Files baby.
Oh, yeah. it was horrible.
But it's an instant life-changing event.
It really is. Something happens inside of you. You never know fear or love until you have the kids.
And he says this all the time. And I think that because Tim loves his daughter so much, and rightfully so, because she's amazing, we're all starting to get the feeling and get the vibe from Tim that we all need to, you know, step to it.
I don't think it's for everybody. But for me, I'm just saying I was so adamant. I was so against it. And maybe those are the guys that are easy to flip over to the other side. Who knows?
Right. I don't know. Because at least you're passionate about it.
Yeah, maybe it is. You know, like Dr. Sophie also. You know Dr. Sophie? Charles? Sophie?
Yeah.
We have him on every couple of weeks. He's a great guy. And he said the opposite of love is not hate. The opposite of love is complacency. You know, it's just...
Indifference.
Yeah. And that's interesting. I never heard that before.
Yeah.
So I guess people are passionate one way or the other. You know, it's easy for them to flip over the other side.
Yeah, and it depends on how rooted your passion. Where's that passion coming from? I mean, a lot of us don't really know ourselves that well.
Yeah.
That's my whole business, is getting people to understand themselves better, getting them to know their blueprint, their owner's manual of kind of who they are. Some of us are just really passionate about, there's no way. I'm not getting married. I'm not having kids. There's no way. Are you kidding me? No way. But then the minute that kid pops out, or the minute they meet the right woman, bam, it's a complete change. And they just didn't know. They didn't have the right experience in front of them, or they just didn't realize it. They had this notion in their head that they just ran with until times changed.
That's my biggest regret in life, is that I didn't have kids earlier. I really would like to have spent, you know, an extra 10 or 15 years with a kid as opposed to having one later on in life. All right, Dr. Reif is with us. Also, Gina Grad is with us. And again, I am the king of the damaged. And this audience is probably psychologically more damaged than most audiences.
Your minion.
But you know what? That's what makes this show interesting. You know, the crazy callers and the crazy idiot who hosts it every night. All right, 520-9710. And 888-520-9710. Come on, you crazies. I know you need Dr. Reif here, and he's willing to help you out. And it is the Tim Conway Jr. Show. Dr. Reif is with us, also Gina Grad, and we're live on 97.1 FM Talk. Everybody, it is the Tim Conway Jr. Show live on 97.1 FM Talk. A quick update for you. The Los Angeles Dodgers, 10, Chicago Cubs, 1 in the bottom of the ninth. So it doesn't look like good news for these Chicago Cub fans. All right, Gina Grad is with us, also Dr. Reif. Real quickly, the Chicago Cubs, I don't believe, have won a World Series in 100 years. I think that's the number.
Take a guess where I'm from.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I know.
Psychologically, is this really damaging for a city or a town or a place like Chicago?
You're going to ask me. I'm crying right now. It depends on your identity with the team. You know how there's like crazed fans?
Right.
It's like constantly getting rejected by a girl over and over and over, like different girls constantly every single year, until you're finally like, okay, it's never going to happen. I'm just going to hang out at home and like not come out of my room ever. Ever.
And I don't know if this is a false statistic, but didn't we talk about one time how the rate of domestic violence goes up around the Super Bowl?
Oh, yeah. But, you know, I thought that was a BS statistic. Yeah. Is that true or not?
I've never heard that.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I do know that there are some people that identify themselves. I do this. I like check the sports sites for my college team.
Right.
Because I had...
What college?
I went to Illinois, University of Illinois, right. Fighting Illini. So I am this Fighting Illini guru guy. I know all the recruits. I know everything that's going on. I check the website. Like, I don't know any of these people. I don't know anything about them. But I know I want to relive those college. You know, you just want to be a part of something.
Absolutely.
And I miss Chicago. So I get it through watching my sports team. And if your sports team is awful, then you start feeling bad about yourself.
Well, yeah, I went to Bowling Green in Ohio.
Oh, okay.
And I think the Midwestern, you know, college teams, there's something different about, you know, about them than USC or UCLA. Like, if UCLA has a bad year, you still have show business and the beach and, you know, the sunshine out here and skiing in the winter. There's a million other things you can do. But if you're going, if you live in Toledo or in Bowling Green or, you know, you're a fan of Notre Dame or whatever, and that team doesn't do well, here comes the winter, and it is psychologically really damaging. It's a real spirit breaker when your team doesn't do well.
Yeah, and then there's a blizzard. And,
right.
Yeah, you're sad.
But on the opposite side, if they do well, like, you know, I never went in Allen Fieldhouse at the University of Kansas. Don't know what it looks like inside. Never stepped foot in
five years.
Never went inside.
I've never stepped my foot inside the Allen Fieldhouse. I was there for 5 years, and the theater building was across the street from Allen Fieldhouse.
Christ.
Now, with that knowledge, I sold my sports pack.
And your dad is a sports announcer.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Now, with that knowledge, when the Jayhawks, Jayhawk OKU, just had their big basketball victory, I walked a little taller for a couple days. Like, I had something to do with it. These are people that I couldn't have cared less about while I was there. But now, like, living out here and having that tie to home, I boosted my confidence.
Let's take some phone calls here for Dr. Reif. He's a psychiatrist who has been on Oprah, and you were on Oprah on Monday, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, let's talk to, how about Kim in Manhattan Beach? You're on 97.1 FM Talk. How are you?
Oh, you're going to put me on the spot, huh? This is supposed to be a question that was going to be filtered to you. Okay, this goes back to histrionics.
Okay.
And I have no knowledge of this. Like, this isn't my background or anything, but I have family members that are afflicted with bipolar. And
I wouldn't trot that out on a first date to your boy, well, to a guy.
No, I mean, it's distant relatives. It's not like cousins and the like. It's
right.
Not like close. It's not like a brother or anything like that.
Mm.
But anyway, my question is, it's with histrionics. I don't know anything about it. And you said it's kind of like the oh my god sort of thing. You know what I mean? Like it's all about me, myself, and I. So my question is it a biomedical kind of disease? Is there a genetic predisposition to it? Is there some sort of catalyst or some sort of life event that triggers it?
Yeah.
Something that triggers it, or how does it come about? Like, how does it manifest in one's life? And what are the ramifications in one's life?
I don't know much about it either. I just read on the internet real quickly, distant relatives with bipolar is the number one cause.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you're in bad shape, baby.
All right,
what do you think, Dr.
So histrionic is a type of personality disorder. So what there are different personality disorders. Personality disorders... Yeah,
is it acting like borderline?
Yes, okay. Another personality disorder. There's borderline, there's sociopathy, there's, you know, there's histrionic, narcissistic.
My sister majored she has a... what do you call it? A master's in psychology. I didn't call her to ask her about this because she doesn't know I'm calling in, but she knows a lot about this, but she never once mentioned to me histrionics.
Yeah, so bipolar is a neurobiological change in your brain. There's something different about somebody's brain who has bipolar illness.
It's a biomedical thing, yeah.
Which is easier to cure?
Yeah, that's a really good question.
Contain.
Because
thank you.
You're welcome. Technologically, we have meds that can really control the symptoms associated with bipolar disorder.
Right.
So
okay.
Bipolar disorder can be scary, but they're great. I mean, great achievements being made by people with bipolar disorder.
Depending on your, if you're like a level one, a level two, if you're like, you know, B or like whatever. She discussed with me like in depth because of our cousin, like all the different, you know, things about it, because he was going to stay at my house and she like had to like debrief me on it. So how is histrionic treated? Like, are there meds like there is with bipolar, or, you know, is there like a synopsis or a guideline of the symptoms and conditions that you can give me? And is there like an age that there's an onset? And is it similar to the bipolar where, so with women, sometimes with bipolar in menopause, it'll like dissipate?
Okay, so...
with a broader question.
All right, Kim, please.
Oh, jeez. God.
All right, question number six.
Yeah.
Question
85.
What are we talking about again?
I don't know.
Okay, so just real quick. With histrionic personality disorder, it's usually developed over just the way you live, your environment. There is some family, you know, if you have a family that acts out, and I'll just give you a couple of the examples, like inappropriately sexually seductive, displaying rapid shifts of expression, has a style, like your style of speech that's dramatic and up, all of that kind of stuff, and there's many more in the histrionic personality type. It's a development process that gets embedded in your personality, and the way you relate to other people is histrionic. It's in this mode. So it's not like you're just born with it and you just act that way. It's environmentally driven, and it's how you relate to the world. So it takes therapy and working with the therapist and working on why you act this way in the world and how is it impacting your life negatively so that you can kind of tone it down a bit.
Is it anything to do with the way your parents treated you?
It could very much be that way. You know, I always say this. It's kind of funny in therapy, when I'm doing therapy with somebody, there's that running joke of like, well, tell me about your childhood. Okay, I can be a therapist.
Right.
Hey, look, I just said it. Well, the reason is the way we adapt to our primary caregivers, our mom and our dad. That's our first same-sex and opposite-sex relationship. Okay?
Right.
And the way that we navigate in that world will dictate how we are later on in life. If I never attached to my mom and it was always about her needs and not my needs, I'm eventually going to be 25 and I'm going to have a woman that I'm dating, and I'm going to think at some point, initially I won't, but when I'm emotionally attached to this woman I'm dating, I'm going to think, well, it's all about her needs. It's not about my needs. And I'm going to make up stuff.
Right.
Because my only relationship with a woman that was emotional was my mom, who never let me have my own needs. So I'm suddenly going to pick fights with some woman when I'm 25 and have no idea why.
Sound familiar, anybody?
Yeah. All right, Kim, we thank you for calling. Let's talk to, how about Frank and Azusa? You're on 97.1 FM Talk. How are you?
Yes, Dr. Reed, earlier in the program you indicated a description of a sociopath, and when I heard that I thought to myself, well, I think the President of the United States fits that description. Am I correct?
Wow, what a question.
Yeah, and could the President be a sociopath?
Well,
he could be. I mean, is this president a sociopath?
Yeah, the current one, right?
Yeah.
Failure to conform to social norms with respect to lawful behaviors, deceitfulness, impulsivity, irritability and aggressiveness, reckless disregard for safety of others, consistent irresponsibility by failure to honor financial obligations or with lack of remorse. Those are the primary.
Can you make that a case for anybody, though?
Yeah, you. That's my point.
Don't you sort of have to be a little off your rocker to want to be president of the United States, anyway?
You definitely sell your soul a little bit and sacrifice some of your family background, just your beliefs, because you got, again, right, you're appeasing other people. So it's a tough one, because if this was a person that had disregard for safety and a lack of remorse and all that other stuff, and they're not in that kind of elitist position, then I would say absolutely yes. But if you go by the strict definition of antisocial personality disorder, you know, those criteria are pretty high up in regards to our current president's status. So I don't want to diagnose our president, but
right,
you know, there's some truth to that.
Yeah, but isn't everybody who becomes a politician, or 99% of them, isn't that a real narcissistic and a power hungry and a mental illness in and of itself?
I don't know if I call it a mental illness, but I think that if you decide you're going to be president, it would be great if every candidate had to undergo a psychiatric examination prior to the debate.
Right. The White House would be empty.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah. So we could see their motivation. I think it's about motivation. I legitimately think there are some politicians out there that really are service-oriented and are like, I'm willing to take the blows of politics in order to try to make the world a better place because of the work that I can do. I think there are legitimately those people out there.
Right.
But the higher the stakes in regards to the presidency, the more games you got to play, the more politics, so to speak, there is, the more diplomacy there is, and the more you have to appease everybody, which is impossible.
Now, Dr. Reef is with us, also Gina Grab. And tell me if this is a problem. I did this in a drugstore the other day. I was going to get a prescription filled, and the woman that was in front of me in line, she got her prescription filled, and she was paying for it. And then she decided at the pharmacy counter to put all of her products out of the cart and put them up on the pharmacy counter when there was a line of people waiting to get their drugs who weren't feeling that well. And she had total disregard for everybody else in line and wanted to pay for all of her stuff up front as opposed to taking it to the to one of the lines in the back or in the front of the store. So under my breath, and I could hear myself saying this, but nobody else could, I called her the C word, right? And it was loud enough where I could hear it. And I go, oh, that felt pretty good. And then I walked around the store doing it to other chicks. And I would say like, she's a, right? And I go, oh, that feels real cool.
Hey,
I
Dr.
Like
Reed,
is that what he said earlier?
Yeah. Karen asked Tim about mom.
Got it.
Yeah.
Any correlation?
She's no longer around. I couldn't lay that on her. But no, but I thought that was, now that's like a real psychological problem, isn't it?
Nah.
Did that feel good?
Just blowing off a little steam.
You should try that when you're in the market, fellas. It really feels good.
I don't know if your audience needs to be doing that, but
They probably already are.
Yeah, I bet they are.
He probably learned it from somebody.
Yes. All right, Frank and Azusa, thanks for calling. Great question. Paula in Carson, you're on 97.1 FM Talk. How are you?
Hi.
Hey.
I would like to know, is it possible for a sociopath like to fall in love?
Geez, I don't know. Can sociopaths fall in love? Well, they can call talk radio.
They can see. You know, I got to tell you, Paula, that is a fantastic million-dollar question. I get asked that question a lot. And I have a sociopath, a couple that I've seen in my practice, and they've asked the same question. It'll be like, Doc, listen, I don't really care about a lot of things that's going on in the world. And I don't care about a lot of people. And I want to care. I mean, I don't think a sociopath, the average sociopath that just comes in at least for treatment, is like, hey, I don't want to be this way. I am, and I want to change.
What's the treatment for that? Is it drugs with a combination of therapy?
There's really not much in the way of drugs.
Really?
It's therapy-based.
And that's a long process, huh?
It's a long process. That's why personality disorders are hard to treat, because it's primarily therapy. I mean, there's some research looking at different medications on different, on borderline or on a couple of others, but primarily, it's a therapeutic thing. You need to slowly shift the way that person thinks about the world and themselves, and it's difficult. So the quick answer, Paula, is I think in treatment, yes, a sociopath can love. Out of treatment, there's lots of pathological unhealthy relationships, or even relationships that start out unhealthy that turn healthy because you met the right person.
Right.
And that's why they say there's always somebody for everyone.
Right.
So I would say, yes, they can love, but it's a difficult process.
Hey, Paula, do you consider yourself a sociopath?
No, not me.
Okay. Oh. All right. Thanks for calling, darling.
Dr. Eve, I have a question for you about that. Do you think that it's hard to treat people with those kind of behavioral disorders because it's so hard to diagnose? Because for so long, people are just walking around and not saying, wow, I think that person needs help. It's, wow, they're just an a-hole. I don't want anything to do with them.
You're totally right. Yeah, because I don't like to pathologize people. You know, like Gina, you know, I could just say all sorts of things, but I wouldn't. I don't like to pathologize people. And when someone comes into my office, I will say, okay, maybe they have traits of being a narcissist or a sociopath, but I'm just going to watch and wait and see what plays out. And over time, you can diagnose this if you've seen someone in all aspects of their personality and how they deal with stress and conflict resolution and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
But you're right, because for a lot of the times, you'll have friends and you'll be like, God, she's such a jerk. What's her deal? Why is she like that?
Yeah.
She's so self-absorbed, or she's like all over the place, or she's like mean, you know? And then over time, that those patterns are consistent, and you realize, wow, these are a cluster of symptoms that make this diagnosis.
Now, again, Dr. Reif is with us. If you have a question for him, 520-9710 and 888-520-9710. You may have seen him on Oprah Winfrey on Monday. And you're being pursued by everybody. I mean, you're really, you've got a lot of things going
on. It's kind of a big deal.
Yeah. All right. Now, I got a quick question for you here. I have, and I've noticed this over the last couple of years, that all of my friends, without an exception, are all angry effing guys. I don't have friends who, like, get up in the morning and go jogging, like, oh, isn't life great? Isn't this great? This is unbelievable. Every one of my friends is angry as F. But that's the way. But I also think that if you're not angry as F, that you probably don't have much of a sense of humor. And if you don't have any sense of humor, I have no patience for you whatsoever. Like, I think I developed, I mean, obviously my dad is a very funny guy, and I probably, you know, was around funny people my whole life. But I think where I developed at least the ability to appreciate a great sense of humor, if not have one myself, is at the racetrack. I think everybody who is at the racetrack is a funny effing guy. You know, you almost have to be. You're out there, you know, spending your last dime on rent, on the outcome of a horse race, and everybody has a colorful personality and, a million stories of being down and out. But is that odd that all of my friends are angry as F?
I don't know. That's such a funny question. I'm curious. Can we do like instant therapy right now?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. So I'm going to ask you a couple of questions first. When you say angry, do you mean sarcastic angry? Or like you're detaching from the world
angry?
Yeah,
like nobody's homicidal or suicidal or anything like that kind of piss. They're just pissed at everybody. You know, at their wives, their kids, but they're funny about it, you know?
So it's like you're communicating through this kind of like funny anger.
It's exactly
setup
right.
That you guys have. Yeah, so I view that as male bonding. That's your way of male bonding.
Okay.
Right? And you're doing it through angry sarcasm, you know? Have at it.
Yeah. I mean,
that bullet.
I but my wife said to me the other day, I was in my office on the computer, and I went, God damn it, Jesus Christ. And she comes in, she goes, you all right? And I said, yeah, what's wrong? She goes, well, you were swearing in here. I go, no, I wasn't. She goes, yeah, you're just swearing. What are you swearing at? I go, that's the way I am all day. I just swear all day.
Okay, I just have one more question. You swear all day. You say the C word under your breath randomly. There's something called Tourette's syndrome. I don't really know if we need to go there yet, but it's in the differential right now.
And he has no recollection of it.
Yeah. Right. What did I say? What?
Dr. Reif is with us. Can you spend another hour with us?
Sure, why not?
All right, excellent. All right, we're going to take one more phone call here, and then we're going to take a break and spend the next hour with Dr. Reif here. Very entertaining guy. And what is your website? How do people get a hold of you, or you got any info like that?
Yeah, it's drreef.com. Doctor spelled out DOCTOR, reef.com.
And REEF.
Right.
All right, drreef.com. Let's talk to, how about, maybe Shelly in Los Angeles. You're on 97.1 FM Talk. How are you?
Hi.
Hey.
Hi, Dr. Reif.
Hey, Shelly, what's up?
I'm just having some issues with my boyfriend of 2 years who I've been with, and we're always talks about getting married, but like my brother and sister are not sort of speaking to me right now about him, and I've lost a couple friends over him, and they just don't think he's like that guy for me, and they're willing to like not be my friend because they feel so strongly about it, and it's just like tearing me apart.
Sounds like my wife calling.
But I love him, and I think he's a great man. He has, like, a really, it's a hard, just, he has a past that's, like, you know, for a parent or for, like, you know, a sibling to see, like, their, you know, sister with somebody like that. I think it's just hard for them, but at the same time, I don't know if, like, what I'm supposed to do. Like, am I just supposed to, like, be my boyfriend who I love, or?
All right, well, that's an interesting question. When do you decide between your husband and your wife or your boyfriend or girlfriend and family and friends?
And I don't know anyone who hasn't been in this exact dilemma.
Yeah, it is tough.
Yeah, who do you choose? Some things that I would want to know is, first off, why is she with him? What are the qualities about him that she really digs? And what are the qualities that the family and friends don't like about him?
That's interesting. Why are you with this dude?
He's like such a, yes, I'm like kind of like a more quieter person. I'm outgoing, but like, you know, I'm like a little more reserved, and he's so out there and he's funny and like.
But what do your parents and your friends hate about him?
He comes from a family of alcoholics. He's been married before, he's been divorced. He has a kid.
Is he older than you?
Yeah, he's a good 9-10 years older than me.
So is he a role model for you? Like, is he a guy that's kind of showing you the way because you're quiet and he's so outgoing and you can experience life through his eyes, so to speak?
We feed off of each other, so it's not, I'm not just like this little shy, quiet person. Like, I have a personality, and I'm like, you know, I'm out there too, but like we've always just kind of balanced each other out. And but he, you know, he does have his like past, and like I don't think they can see past that. And he's got, you know, he's like tattooed up.
He's tatted up.
Well, you know, and once again, alcohol takes a hit. Unbelievable,
yeah.
Huh?
There you go. Well, relationships are, yeah, I'd love to say that a great relationship is all about love, but you need more than love to have a really good relationship. Love's great, and it helps, and it matters, but you need more to it. And things like commonalities and mutual support and loyalty and trust and, you know, sense of humor and how you feel about the person, you know, in regards to what they can do with their lives and all of that plays into it. And if you're going to make a decision to forego your friends and your family and all of their thoughts because he's risky, and to be with him, you better understand exactly what you're getting into and all the risks associated with that, with him having that alcohol background in his family and already being married and divorced.
Yeah, and all tatted up.
And all tatted up.
Well, Jesus. And I don't know if Shelly feels this way, but I got to tell you, nothing a girl likes more than a fixer-upper.
Well, yeah.
Seriously. And I mean, I think that probably has a lot to do with it, whether she knows it or not. It's just, something I can put my energy into, someone I can turn around, I won't say a project, but something I can really put that effort into. And boy, do we like a fixer.
And my grandfather always told me, says, if you're going to be an alcoholic, don't get tattoos. because the you want to look as conservative as possible. So when you get pulled over by the cops, they don't hassle you. So I thank my grandfather for that piece of advice.
So your grandfather looks at you and thinks about when you get pulled over by the cops.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's nice.
But, and
yeah.
Also, I learned something from, who was the guy who hosted Tim Russert? Tim Russert wrote a book about his father. And one of the things that I'll always take away from that book is if you drink, you've got to remember to eat. You know, a lot of people go to Vegas, they drink all night, they forget about a meal, and then they wake up hungover, and it ruins their vacation. So if you drink, eat. All right?
The more you know.
Thank you very much. All right, Dr. Reif is with us. Also, Gina Grad is with us as well. And he is a psychiatrist who has a tremendous background and has a lot of answers that are going to make a lot of people feel better tonight. Dr. Reif, DocTorReef.com. And it is the Tim Conway Jr. Show with Dr. Reif, and we're live on 97.1 FM Talk.